Welcome to Cloud at Microsoft Subject Matter Expert, or SME, Roundtable. I'm Sherry Bettine, and I'll be your host. We are the IT Showcase team, and we love to talk to you, our customers, about how Microsoft does IT. I'm here with many of our cloud experts who work on cloud adoption here at Microsoft. This is your opportunity to ask direct questions of our SMEs and receive candid answers. You can start submitting your questions now through the live Skype Q&A window, and I also have some of the questions you submitted in advance that I'll pull from. We will make every effort in the next hour to answer all of your questions, but if we don't, we'll stay behind in the studio and continue answering questions and post the extended footage along with this video on our website at microsoft.com/ITShowcase. We'll get started with our experts introducing themselves. David.
My name is David Leff. I'm a network architect in Microsoft IT, working on cloud and edge technologies.
Hi, I'm Ken Knight. I'm an enterprise architect working in Microsoft IT on cloud adoption and cloud strategy for moving Microsoft's workloads to the cloud.
Hi, I'm Jim Adams. Senior Program Manager with Microsoft IT, working in the Office 365 space.
And I'm Rob Bedard. I'm a Senior Service Engineer, and I work on cloud adoption, simplification, and acceleration within Microsoft IT.
Okay, great. Well, let's get started with our first question. We keep hearing about how cloud is enabling agility. Is agile training required in order to adopt the cloud?
Who wants to?
Ken?
I think that it's not required, but once you have started to move to the cloud, you can start iterating a lot faster. I think it's a natural outcome of moving to the cloud. And we internally at Microsoft have promoted and got a lot of teams moved off of Waterfall onto Agile, and very few people are left that are not working in an agile manner now.
Yeah, you're right, it's an enabler, right? I mean, so when you think about agile, when you think about DevOps, these kind of, those philosophies and a methodology, right, they are cloud enables, and they work very well together. I mean, even, and to your point around the waterfall stuff, even in our systems of record, those big applications, which are traditionally very waterfall in nature, we found a lot of those tend to start to support the business have gone to that agile.
Well, the business wants more and more, faster and faster.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the key aspects of cloud technology, right, is the agility it brings with a little a versus the large a in the agile methodology. And I think that they play off each other really, really well.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Next. Question for David. What future changes do you anticipate for the network due to the influence of the cloud?
Many, many changes. Essentially, when we're moving a lot of applications to the cloud, particularly in terms of user productivity applications, the patterns that we saw from client to application have changed. Mm. What we used to see is we used to see kind of horizontal traffic leaving a building or a campus and going to an on-premises data center. Now we're seeing that traffic exit our network and go to the cloud, public cloud, on the internet. So we're having to change the way that the network operates. So rather than enabling a bunch of horizontal traffic, now all the traffic is going essentially north-south to the internet. That's a major change. In addition to going to cloud, the way that people use devices is also changing. The way that people actually work how the cloud enables them to work is changing their behavior as well. So our company strategy is not only cloud first, but it's also mobile first. So the ability to do your work from anywhere enabled by the cloud is changing the way we have to deliver network services themselves.
Mm. People aren't always on campus.
They're not always on campus. They can work essentially from anywhere, mm-hmm. particularly against, you know, those public cloud services that one of the fundamental attributes of cloud is ubiquitous access, and that means internet.
It'd be an interesting statistic to see what percentage of users or what percentage of time is being spent checking email on their mobile device versus checking their mail on their PC
desktop
device.
Laptops, yeah.
We do know that our sales force right now, about 70% of them work mobile out of the office.
That makes sense.
Yeah, for me it's about 50-50. I check Yep. Half the time on my mobile phone device, and then half the time on my PC.
Yes, always on, always connected.
Yep.
So would you say that all the internal traffic inside Microsoft that used to work across Microsoft facilities, and we had a primary, what you'd call east-west, right? That's
yes.
The east-west traffic. West. That's all, now these facilities are all going to the cloud, and the workloads are now moving across Azure as the fabric, and people are just connecting to the cloud, and the cloud has that east-west traffic.
Not all of it quite yet, but a lot of it.
That's the trend.
Yes, that's the trend. That's the direction things are going.
Okay, interesting. Rob, next question for you.
Okay.
When approaching large-scale cloud adoption, what are the key pillars that we've focused on here at Microsoft?
It's a great question. There's, from a less of a technical conversation, perhaps more of a philosophical conversation. We talk about go fast. So a lot of that is kind of not only to enable proof of concept, but also to learn very quickly. And then if we do get it wrong, let's fail and fail fast in that situation. Drop my mic. The situation with that is that you want to iterate incredibly quickly, and you also want to share those learnings. The other thing as well, I think, and we struggled with this early on, is you want to avoid analysis paralysis. You can spend an awful lot of time looking at your portfolio of stuff on premises and trying to figure out whether it will fit. We got to the point where it was just like, let's get to about 80% accuracy from a data perspective and say, let's just move those and start understanding what it looks like for those applications and those workloads to move. Understanding that plans of record will change. Applications have historically had 6 months, 12 months, 18 months plan of records. To support the business, to your point earlier, Sherry, that's no longer a valid plan of record, perhaps. You're going to be iterating. You might have a very thematic plan of record, but you're going to be iterating incredibly quickly.
Priorities change.
Priorities change, absolutely.
And so the plan can quickly adapt to the
absolutely,
changing priorities.
Absolutely, as the business demands dictate. Mm-hmm. I think those are kind of the real pillars of that. So you're really enforcing change within the organization as a change management activity versus here's the technology aspect of it.
I think the development environment allows you to experiment more and try different things quickly to see if they even hold water.
Absolutely.
And then you're able to implement the good ideas and just forget about the bad ones.
Yeah, the bad ones is actually interesting. I mean, one of the things we decided to do as a company, and we've seen this evolution over the last couple of years, is really change the way we reward individuals. And part of that is to look at, you know, if one does fail in a technology problem, that's okay. Let's share those learnings. Let's make that community that can look at that problem and go, maybe we can fix it in a different way, or alternatively acknowledge that that's going to be a challenge moving forward, and then start looking at different ways to handle the problem. So the fail and fail fast, there is the kind of dot, dot, dot after that, and tell everybody about it so people can learn. Bringing that communal knowledge together is really important.
And you're getting better as you're trying new things.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Some will fail, some will succeed,
absolutely.
But you're getting better.
Absolutely.
We are being allowed to fail, which has not been the historical culture in IT.
Correct.
And the other culture that's changed, to Rob's point, our management structure now actually has learned to not require a 3, 6, 9, 12-month plan.
And well, that's the other side of the more agile, right?
The management has to change their expectations. So now what they have, to what Rob was talking about, is they have the sprint they're on, they have the concept of what the high-level backlog is for the next sprint, and the rest is just a prioritized backlog. You review that, and you can glean from that, you know, what's coming in 3, 6, 9 months, but realize it's always subject to change.
Yeah.
Right, and that's the rapid prioritization.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes, we're actually even doing that in the infrastructure space as well, where that in traditional IT was very foreign to us because it usually involved capital investments, things that were long lasting. Mm-hmm. Buy the equipment, you're stuck with it for 3, 5, 7 years. Mm. Now, you know, we've also adopted that agile strategy in the infrastructure space as well, where we can debate what we should do, make a decision very quickly, deploy it, see how it went, and then, you know, continue to move on and, like you said, iterate on what you're doing, which we really didn't have the ability to do in the infrastructure space when you know, we owned everything top to bottom.
And the long lead times for ordering equipment.
Yeah.
Correct. We were looking at, you know, weeks in best cases to months to get something deployed. Mm-hmm. Now it's all software defined, logical, you know, fast as you can deploy it, you know, it's there.
Yeah. Sounds great. Question. DDoS protection on IaaS. We've had a number of consultants, Knox Security and Azure, focused mainly on DDoS protection. They state there is no DDoS protection for IaaS VMs and push for virtual appliance firewalls. What DDoS protection does Azure actually provide to its IaaS VM customers versus what it provides its PaaS customers?
DDoS or DDoS, distributed denial of service attack.
Okay.
Essentially what it is somebody from a location that has network connectivity to your front end service would send malformed packets, too many packets, something to your service to attempt to either cause it to go down or a degraded level of service. Azure does have some capabilities in their fabric to detect a denial of service attack and shut it down at their fabric level. It has to be pretty gross and pretty obvious for them to do this. Inherently in Azure IaaS, where you want to treat that as just any old, you know, virtual machine workload that's exposed to whatever network you choose to connect it to, they don't do anything special for that, special for the fact that it is IaaS or that it is a virtual machine. You will get that fabric level DDoS protection. But yes, it is true that if you actually want to provide your own denial of service and get more granular based upon the way your application behaves and some of its tolerance levels, you will have to procure your own denial of service protection. And that could come in the form of a virtual appliance. It could also come in the form of a network service that you consume from somebody who provides something like a web application firewall or a cloud gateway service would do it as well.
Okay, and what do we do for our own?
What do we do for our own? We actually do leverage our own firewalls that we use, next generation firewalls on the workloads that are actually facing the internet. And for PaaS, we are adopting web application firewalls as well.
So there's a few third-party vendors that provide that for us,
yeah.
And we're using that technology.
Okay, great. Next up for Jim. What are some proven practices in outsourcing the Microsoft SaaS offerings?
Okay, I'm going to assume we're going to talk about Office 365. So for other enterprises wishing to make the plunge into Office 365, the best advice I can probably give you is you want to take an inventory of what you have and move the easy stuff and the most important stuff first. It's not necessary to move everything into the cloud. Take this as an opportunity to clean house and rely on organics. Rely on the actual users determining what is important and what is not important, and give them the tools to self-migrate first and then put in a plan to systematically bring aboard the rest of the stuff.
Like when you're moving houses, you get rid of a lot of stuff before you start.
Exactly.
Moving.
It doesn't make any sense to order the dumpster and have it delivered at your new place of residence. Have it delivered to your old place and get rid of the stuff so you don't have to move it.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not want to be 100% into the cloud. You may want to remain a hybrid environment where you have some assets still on premises and most of your assets in the cloud. And that's certainly what Microsoft has done.
What
adopted.
Types of things would you leave on-premise?
The things that are very, very difficult to refactor for the cloud, maybe some line-of-business applications that have a lot of connectivity to back-end systems, maybe some things that are really old. Maybe you can sunset those.
So they retire in place.
Retire in place, mm-hmm. And then refactor or renew that functionality with new applications in the cloud, taking advantage of Azure services. Microsoft is approximately 97% in the cloud, 3% on-premises, precisely for those reasons, and also the fact that Microsoft manufactures software for both on-premises as well as Office 365 in the cloud. And we have a commitment to dog food, all of our products. Mm-hmm. So we have to have some assets still on-premises so that we can do that.
When you talk about the 97%, you're referring to the Office 365 footprint, right, versus our line of business apps, the SaaS solution versus our line of business apps, which is a different view into that.
Now we're actively managing, and Rob's helping to drive this, getting all of the applications in all of our business units to have a cloud plan.
Yeah.
And so we want 100% of that in the cloud. But as Jim pointed out, there are some physical on-premise requirements. So there'll be this very small noise level residual thing that's going to be on-premise.
I think one of the servers, I was talking to somebody yesterday about this, we have to pay certain vendors, we actually have a box with some telco cards in there, that are physical cards that need to be attached to copper. Yeah. We don't have a software-defined solution for that yet. So, and I just think, that literally are fax cards.
Yeah.
So at some point that will die, and the effort to lift that and re-engineering around that is significant and probably.
So that's a retire in place.
I would say that's a retire in place, absolutely.
Or if it doesn't retire, it doesn't bother us too much because it's so vanishingly small.
It's noise.
It's noise. It's not even noise at that point. So, I mean, just simply moving 80, 90% of what we have, in traditional IT to the public cloud, a company the size of Microsoft, that's a huge undertaking.
We're getting the
huge improvement.
Yeah.
It's the edge cases, we're well aware of them, but they don't bother us too much.
And we're not going to, you don't spend a lot of time losing sleep or listening to that, we're not going to build a solution around that kind of edge case. When you think about cloud adoption for line of business applications, I go back to the 80%, the 80-20 rule. If you get the 80% right, the 20% will probably come with you.
Yeah.
So
some of it may just be too costly to even.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, there are some applications that, so our strategy is very much IaaS first. If the application's going to have investment into it, then we expect it to, once it's gone to IaaS, we will evolve it to a PaaS solution. So if it's net new or re-architected, it's going to get a PaaS or a commodity play with SaaS if it exists. If you get to the IaaS piece and you start moving those kind of line of business applications, we can get a tremendous amount of momentum in that space. The apps that don't move that are super complex, they're going to get re-architected for PaaS. We're not going to do a large scale system of record. We're going to re-architect that for PaaS. So if you think of like a large scale sales solution, that's going to get a PaaS first before we spend any time worrying about it in IaaS. From a strategic standpoint and from a program standpoint, the dev test workloads will go to
easiest.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a great opportunity for do proof of concept, right? Mm-hmm. And we were somewhat fortuitous in that when we started getting aggressive around this, we were closing a leased data center, which was a dev test data center. Mm. You have that opportunity there to go, okay, I could refresh all of this hardware in another data center, or I can change the lens on how we look at the problem and go, can we move these dev test workloads to the cloud and learn and build that kind of DNA within the organization that says, okay, this is how we start operating traditional IT, not refactored for IaaS, not refactored for PaaS or SaaS, but IaaS workloads, and how do they operate in the cloud? There's an opportunity there to do a tremendous amount of learning.
Yep. It's a great way to start.
And absolutely, it's great.
Also a forcing faction.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whenever we're shutting down a data center, there's a deadline, right?
Yes. Yeah. That project was successful. We closed that data center.
You're going to get off of it.
You're going to get out of there, yeah. And it was a really interesting lever. So not only do you have, when we talk about cloud adoption internally to Microsoft, but when I speak to customers, there is that C-suite, the CEO, the CMO, the CFO, looking for very particular things. It is the CIO's responsibility to deliver on those things. So that's where you get that kind of opportunity. Okay, so you've got that pressure coming down. We're also closing a data center. We've also got, to your point, we've got hardware refreshes going on pretty regularly. There's an opportunity there to go, okay, let's just change the way we do this and realize some real opportunities and real benefits that going to the cloud has given us so far.
I think today you can't launch anything on physical, unless it's like highest level.
Yeah, absolutely. We have an exception process that the chief financial officer, Amy Hood, will look at, and there's actually a few other individuals in that process, will look at our request and go yes or no.
just the fact that you have to do that probably stops a lot
from happening. Given the choice of going to talk to a CFO or maybe I can get my app to work in IaaS, I think I'm going to go try the IaaS route.
It does bring some interesting things to light, though, and it allows us to see or identify where we actually have gaps, right? Where we have a workload or we have a IT scenario that just doesn't fit in the cloud, then we understand the gap and we can articulate that gap back to the product team and say, these are the things that an enterprise IT shop cannot move to your cloud service today. Do you plan to address them in the future? Here's why. Do you plan to address them in the future? If not, we have a reasonable explanation as to why.
And then it gets escalated, so therefore, high-level visibility within the organization.
Correct. Yeah.
And we keep harping on it until it's fixed.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the evolution of Azure as a platform, we've seen those changes occur, whether it's, you know, the simplest term IP address changes, maybe static IP addressing or long lease IP addressings, or whether it's multiple IP addresses, to the point where we now have got a more enterprise experience from a portal perspective. Those are all enablers for enterprise IT. Yeah.
Didn't we also have kind of like a trade-in policy? If you traded in one piece of hardware, you could get two VMs in exchange or some points toward those VMs. Didn't we have a program like that?
We had one called, in the early days. Called Cash for Clunkers.
There you go. Cash for Clunkers. Perfect.
Yeah, you traded in an old physical machine for multiple virtual machines. I don't think we've had exactly that going into Azure IaaS, but yes, there's definitely incentives to get there.
Yeah, it went from incentive to mandate when we had a $200 million bow wave of hardware. Because our hardware, we don't buy it like 20% for 5 years over, you know.
Yeah.
We buy it as lumpy. And I think a lot of customers are lumpy too. And so they're going to come up to a certain point in the future where they're looking at, you know, a very significant spend and they have to make a choice.
Yeah.
Either going to the cloud now or I'm going to the cloud in 5 years after that. Well, you better go to the cloud now.
It's a good forcing function.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And it forced us.
Financials. And actually, that leads into the next question. How are you measuring your move to the cloud, and where are you in the process? Ken?
So there's a number of ways to measure it, but right now what we're doing is we're looking at it from a server perspective, a VM OS instance perspective, counting all of them and moving them to the cloud, as well as looking at it from an app perspective, from the portfolio perspective, and having plans to move all of the apps to the cloud. And so those are the two things we're doing. Once we get everything into the cloud, the measurement's going to change. It's going to be more about how efficiently and effectively, cost-effectively, we're running our services. And the notion of application might change into be a services composed of applications. And
because
so
you can
change.
Go to the cloud and be very inefficient too, right?
Oh, yes.
And if you have a mandate to move, you know, all of your capacity out of a couple data centers into the cloud and you don't decrease your footprint, and like by saying, I don't need these redundant environments or I'll spin them up when necessary. And if you don't do something that Rob's passionate about, put in a snooze schedule.
Yeah, and Ken brings up a great point. So, I mean, fundamentally, again, this is it's the cultural change, right? If you do an edit copy, edit paste of your environment and take the processes with you and the way you've thought about infrastructure in the past, then you will be inefficient. Quite bluntly, and
so
we
you're
experience.
Saying if you do everything exactly the same in the cloud that you were doing on premises,
because you've bought hardware in the past for burst, that's what you've had to, you know, to support a
for the
system.
Highest level,
the highest level every single time, and it's been woefully oversubscribed, woefully overprovisioned, and woefully underutilized at the same time. So, the opportunity to, when you start moving a landscape, is to look at the landscape you have. Decommission what you don't need anymore. We put some programs in place to go, let's look at CPU utilization at some very, very low levels and say, what's cold and what's frozen out there? And thousands upon thousands of instances of OS, whether it's a physical or a VM, we've discovered that. So that starts, you start to get to drive that out of the system.
So you had reports or metrics?
Reporting, yeah. We had metrics, a lot of Power BI to kind of report back on that. Then as you move, you're doing a lot of right-sizing. Again, I mean, to be honest, quite frankly, when we first started, it was very simple on how we did our right-sizing. It was kind of CPU utilization. How does this map to a particular SKU in Azure? What that allowed us to do is to start to drive efficiencies into the system. From there, if we think about dev and test environments, we have the weekend. If that environment's not in use over the weekend, let's what we call snooze, which is kind of deallocates the VM. So your cost goes down to about 10%, right? You just pay for storage cost. And we've realized somewhere in the region of 10 million hours of what we call snooze now. So we're not paying for that compute time when we're doing that. That's not even thinking about doing it on the weekdays where you're not using dev and test on the weekdays potentially. Yeah. I mean, that's actually probably, if it's probably like 80%, if you look at the 100% cost of a weekend schedule of like 60 hours maybe, it's 52 hours in the week as well. So you've got an opportunity cost to do that there. So
and
you get
to like turning the lights off.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the weekend,
and that's hard enough as it is. That's hard enough as it is to get people to do that.
There's another massive savings we found. There's a whole bunch of servers we had and nobody took ownership of.
Yeah.
The groups had moved on, reorgs had happened, the app may or may not be in use. It's the frozen servers that Rob was talking about. And so we didn't even know who to say, hey, you know, is this yours? Are you using it? You know what we did?
We just turn them off.
Scream test
them and turn them off.
Turn it off, see you scream.
You put a sign on it that says, you know, this is under scream test. So when you log in, you see a big, huge thing that says you're under scream test. And then if no one does anything in a week, I think it is.
It's kind of a process around email to the owner plus the manager of that person, a log on screen that says, you know, anyone, hello, anyone using this. At some point, it gets into they do reboots, and then they start disconnecting the network. So if there's a virtual network on it, let's kill the virtual network on it. So one gets to get out of that.
There's several kind of opportunities for the owner to say stop.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes. I'm using
this. A failure rate on that has been, single digits on a monthly basis where we've gone, whoops, we turned the wrong thing. Some people scream. Yeah, but.
The timing of the screen.
Yes,
it's wrong.
Yeah. That's a forcing factor, though, to clean up your backyard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it kind of helps you get data, the hygiene of your data on your infrastructure.
Don't move the trash.
Smart.
And that's how you get efficient, right? So
absolutely.
You're not paying for what you aren't consuming.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think finally in that, so once you're there, it's keeping the optics on that from a monitoring perspective. So you get the right telemetry out of it to go, hey, is this in use? Is it in use now? We have seen behavior where it's like, okay, you were not using it up here. We've given you up here now because you said you were using it, and now you're not using it again. Mm-hmm. So we have to go out of that. So you have to kind of build that into it. The one thing I would touch on is when we think about dev test, we talk about, we have the two schools of thought of this right now, and we're kind of going back and forth a little bit on this. Is like, an environment should have one pre-production environment. That's it. Or alternatively, it can have as many as it likes, but they better be highly utilized, like say 60%, you know, based on CPU, RAM, network, ingress, egress. So a blend of that. So whatever you choose in that, just make sure it's heavily utilized. If not, get aggressive around right sizing.
Yeah.
Because that's the way you start driving efficiencies into IaaS when you're moving what is effectively legacy or traditional IT that is not really. The behavior is not there to kind of do those kind of things in the past. You're not going to go turn off a physical server in a data center. You're not going to turn off VMs in a data center that's on premises because there's no very little value to that.
It's a sunk cost.
Yeah, it's a sunk cost.
It's dedicated capacity. Yeah.
Right.
In the cloud, you shouldn't view it as dedicated capacity. Think of it as dedicated expense.
Yeah.
Right? And let's be frugal.
It's like the electricity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's another trend.
Shut out the lights when leaving the room.
There's also another trend to get in the whole DevOps space to start what we call flighting or tagging in Visual Studio Online, where we can start testing in production. And if you do that, you don't need a pre-production environment. You can deploy your stuff into production, and then you can say, for this API that we just deployed, I only want it to fire the new API when I see a test client come in. And so then you do your testing in production with test clients. Or you could say 10% of the users, you know, get this, you know, new experience. And let's see how it reacts. And let's monitor and get rich metrics.
And these are even in IaaS solutions we're doing that today. Those applications are evolving to PaaS, but this is traditional IT VM experience
that
we're doing that in.
It's just good behavior.
Yeah.
You can do it in IaaS too.
Great.
And that will save a lot of money.
And we're starting to realize some of that, right?
Yeah,
just beginning to get these behaviors in.
I mean, but look at the incidents. So we've seen incident cost or incident tickets go down. Even just moving from on-premises to IaaS, why? Because we're not worried about the physical host and the hypervisor anymore. We're just worried about the VM. So even inherently, you're kind of dropping some of that support out because you're not having to worry about that. That's the Azure's fabric job now. We don't have to worry about that. That's the cloud provider's job to do that now. So even there, we've seen a decrease in just incidents from an OS perspective. It's probably like a third, maybe about 30% drop.
And then we can move up the stack.
20 to 30%. As you go up the stack, obviously.
And if we can move up the stack, what do you expect for a drop in that?
When you get a PaaS?
Yeah, go to PaaS.
Well, then, you get out of the business of, I don't have to worry about my OS anymore, right? Yeah. I'm not worried about middleware or anything like that. I'm just talking about my application and my data. The advantage of that is, I haven't seen incident trends around that yet. It would be nice to see incident trends around that. The advantage of that, though, is also is you get the people that are working on that product to start focusing on a real business problem or a consumer request, as opposed to worrying about how my middleware is configured or how my OS is patched. Mm-hmm. That's the fabric's job now. I get to get my engineers go and focus on, let's go deliver on customer promises and business problems, as opposed to I'm going to go twiddle this bit of middleware to make it work properly.
And that applies to the SaaS.
Obviously, as you go further, as you get to the commodity play, it's like, hey, I get it out of the business even further of even like almost running the app at that point.
Now that we've got to IaaS, our next step.
Absolutely.
IaaS or SaaS.
Yeah.
And I want to see a metric of no IaaS.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a goal.
As a goal.
As a goal.
Yeah. It's probably a 5-6 year goal, but
yeah.
Let's start counting the IaaS instances and get them down to zero.
Well, as applications get re-architected,
yeah, absolutely.
They'll be off. And as they retire, they'll be off. So one of those two situations will happen.
Yeah.
It's a very similar process to the on-prem to IaaS. We can use IaaS to
pass.
Yeah.
Next question. If you look at adoption, how do you currently look at and react to the ask for more alignment between business and IT?
I'm hoping I'm going to answer this question correctly. I think, and I'm pleased if the person that's asked the question wants to follow up because I may answer this incorrectly. From an IT to business alignment, we have to, I tie it to almost to the evolution of the IT pro skill set, right? We are no longer, and speaking for, candidly, I used to be a storage engineer. I used to get to play with arrays and fabric switches, and it was always the application's fault or the host's fault. It was never storage's fault, and or the network, and then David would go, no, it's storage, and I go, no, it's network, and then there'd be an argument around that. The evolution of that kind of twiddling with settings job has evolved into more of an either architect, DevOps engineering role, which we kind of, the nexus from an IT pro skill set is DevOps and engineering, right? And, there's a philosophy there, and then there's the actual skill set. Our storage engineers are now storage architects, not only thinking about in the on-premises world, but also in the cloud world. Other kind of roles, when I look at that situation, have gone to more business partner roles. So the really expectation is to be able, not only to be able to talk to my software engineering partners, but also to talk to the business partners to understand what their needs actually are. So it's really an uplift in skill set. Does that, the twiddle job still exist? Yes, it does, but in a different fashion now. What we're looking at is to be more of a partner to the business, to go to the table, to be able to talk to them in what it means to be successful, what their needs are for their solution, whatever they're trying to deliver.
Several things we've done specifically for that question. At the engineering team level that Rob was talking about, we've moved from uptime to business metrics.
Yeah.
So we want
what's the customer experience
and the instrumentation for the applications to be at the business uptime. So availability for the business to be executed end to end on it, not the uptime of the services. So we're changing the behavior, the culture, the telemetry for the engineering teams. But going another level up, we're moving a little bit away from the notion of application, and we've restructured internally at Microsoft along the lines of services. And so we have services, service lines, and service offerings. And we have a service structure that's being played across the whole company. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to report out our efficiencies and our executions on executing these services, which may or may not have one-to-many applications in it.
Yeah.
And so we're starting to deploy subscriptions and map those subscriptions, Azure subscriptions, to services. Where we map the resource groups within those subscriptions to applications. There's still a little bit of a need for application telemetry in the system, but at the executive level, mm-hmm. we've moved to managing change management and have a special board that's a governance mm-hmm. board for changes at a high level to the services, service lines, and service offerings.
Yeah,
Rob, you mentioned the Twiddle jobs.
Yeah.
They still exist. Where do they exist?
So that now, quite frankly, is a managed service contract mm-hmm. with a technology partner. So what we've done there is to take those kind of processes, automate them as much as we possibly can, and then pass that over to a managed service provider within IT. Does that those jobs probably exist within Microsoft? You know, if you worked in the Azure team, there's probably that job exists somehow. But in IT, I don't want to spend my time doing that. I'll work on the automation and the processes, but I'm going to hand that role off to a managed service contract.
So if you were in that role in another mm-hmm. company,
yeah.
what would you be doing now?
Okay, so, I mean, that's a great question because, you know, well, what's my job future look mm-hmm. like is ultimately mm-hmm. what you're asking there. So if I go back a couple of years, our senior leadership within IT started to change the way they were talking, the language they were using. You know, obviously cloud was there mm-hmm. and that was kind of one of the forcing factors for this. But what we've done is not necessarily, hey, go read this technology pamphlet, book, whatever you want to do this technology training, but more so focus on, say, the cultural change. So we've given people plenty of opportunity to uplift their skills from a technical standpoint, no doubt, but also from a change the way we talk to our business partners, talk to each other. So lifting that up, I mean, some key points, right? A lot of people read the Phoenix Project, which is a DevOps handbook by George Spafford and Gene Kim. I mention that book so much to people, I feel like I should get a cut at this point. that's been the first part of it. The other thing is we're not allowed to be, Microsoft has historically, you know, there's a lot of silos within the organizations. That is not allowed anymore. So not only has HR changed the job model, but we've gone and done, you know, suddenly storage and networking suddenly need to be talking to each other and having a civil relationship. So Lencioni's Five Dysfunctions of a Team, everyone's kind of done that because those teams are becoming more malleable in nature. And then, you know, so that's kind of the way we kind of talk about that. So giving people the opportunity to go, let's uplift. If you want to keep doing that, by all means, keep doing that. Just be aware that position is going to move. I think really, while I still say that's an ongoing process, I think and it will be for some time. I think we're a lot further down the road than we were.
Are we over the hump?
Oh, yes.
Culture's changed.
Culture's changed significantly, yeah.
One thing to support what you're saying, GitHub, where all of the teams are now moving off of traditional TFS silos mm-hmm. into open source kind of model with GitHub. And mm-hmm. so now all of your code is transparent. Mm-hmm. Things you take dependencies on, you can see the code base.
Yeah.
You can check, you can do a pull request, and you can change that code and submit it back. Mm-hmm. And so people are empowered now. Instead of saying, I won't take a dependency because I can't touch your code.
Yeah, and I think this ties, tie this out within the organization or the team I work in, we have live site reviews. So when we look at a incident within a service, not an application, but a service, and understand what the actual impact was. Not necessarily, well, it blue screened, whatever. What was the impact to the customer? So availability of my server is, who cares?
Zero.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's zero or 100. I don't really mind. What was the service experience like?
Right.
Then you kind of peel it back and go, why? And it turns out maybe we weren't monitoring for a particular trigger. Maybe we hadn't done failure mode effect analysis against a particular part of the stack. But it's that live site review, which means we are the team that works on that DevOps team is now obsessed with or is allegiant to that service. And that's what they're focusing on. And so there's a huge cultural change there.
Yeah, and service is the terms for the customer.
Yeah.
It's in the business terms of running the business service that's supported by the IT system.
And we're building resilience.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot more resilience
absolutely.
In our service
they just assume
than ever
that,
before.
Though. They just assume
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
They want to talk about business transactions per second, cost per transaction, cost of goods sold. Mm-hmm. These are the business terms that we have to get the telemetry baked into the system, which we hadn't done before because we were too busy bailing out, keeping the servers up.
Yeah.
And to add to what you guys have discussed, and also to continue on with this question, I believe IT is being asked to be smarter about the businesses they support. So
absolutely.
We do need to be deeper in finance if we're supporting
absolutely.
Finance, or deeper in HR if we're supporting HR.
Yeah, we've been asked to get out of our cave and go talk to the actual users.
Yeah, exactly.
And understand their world.
Absolutely.
Understand their
When your CEO wants agility, when your CFO wants operational efficiency, and your CMO wants more like unique ways to engage with the customer, there's the C-suite folks doing that. The person that has to deliver on that is the CIO, which ultimately means IT has to step up to be able to support those functions. And that's a very real thing that we are doing today.
And Jim's been getting great accolades and compliments from our C-suite brethren. Partners.
Not Jim Adams.
Right, you need to make clear that it's our CIO, not me. Although I am getting accolades.
Here's an accolade.
We do love Jim.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that we're moving out of a role of being a provider, a technology provider,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes the sole technology provider, the monopoly, the IT monopoly,
yeah.
to being a sourcer and a broker,
yeah,
trusted broker by the business to get to the solutions they need.
Absolutely.
The services they need.
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
The different skill set. That's moving from an engineer to
a trusted partner
mm-hmm.
with the business, as opposed to the, here's my servers, go do your thing.
Turn the knobs.
Go turn the knobs, yeah, exactly.
And cloud and agile behaviors have supported that.
And I think DevOps as well. DevOps is kind of critical.
Yeah.
If you're going to be obsessed around a service,
yeah.
you're going to be allegiant to that service, your feature crew is allegiant to that service,
yeah.
DevOps is the key part of that. You can't have software engineers go, it's not my problem.
Right.
It is your problem. It is everybody's problem that is related into that service.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go to the next question. David, did you have to increase your internet capacity to cope with the public cloud adoption?
Yes, we did. And I touched on a little bit of this in the previous question, but yes. So when those traffic patterns moved from, again, building to data center, mm-hmm. now it's building to internet, essentially, a public destination. You know, the old traditional internet edge that we had was built for browsing the web. And, you know, way back when we decided that the internet was a real thing and was important, it wasn't necessarily business critical. You could get away with not having the internet for a few minutes or a few hours and still get
application
your job done.
Traffic all happened.
Application traffic happened
your
on the internet
yeah.
inside of our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, user productivity happened inside of our environment as well. Not the case anymore. The internet is business critical. We've seen an uptick of traffic within the past year, so 12 to 18 months, increased by a factor of 5.
Wow.
So, and it's continuing to increase. The client flows are getting more numerous and heavier, but we're also starting to see application to application and application to service flows increase as well. When we have business processes and applications or services, that stretch on-prem and cloud. So we are continuing to build not only bigger edges, but more edges as well. So as we want to move essentially that service or that user closer to the resource they want to get to. So rather than having the traditional enterprise hub and spoke network topology, we're moving to a kind of a distributed edge, get you to the closest internet connectivity that you possibly can have. And that's a fundamental architectural change of our network.
Do you think long-term, you know, the concept of a corporate internal network is dead?
Gone. Dead.
I don't think it's gone.
Right.
I think it's fundamentally changed.
Right.
We actually have a internal strategy called Internet First
mm-hmm.
that we're coupling with another one called Wireless First, and basically these two things are aligned with the company-wide strategy of mm-hmm. mobile first, cloud first, cloud first, mobile
and
first.
And as traffic patterns change, when we start moving to more of a PaaS workloads, I mean, the traffic patterns are going to change significantly, right? I mean, the service bus ingress, egress, you know, endpoints as opposed to perhaps like a traditional network connection.
Yes, and it's all virtualized.
Right.
And it changes from, you know, hour to hour, minute to minute, second to second.
So how does security responsibility change in that?
I think they're fundamental responsibilities don't necessarily change, or their expectations don't change, the way that they deliver on those has to change. Mm. Because again, we don't own the network. DevOps is real. The security controls and visibility, places we get visibility to enable us to determine whether we're actually meeting our security policies and compliance commitments, has to push closer to the resource.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain, we don't own the network, your comment?
So once that traffic leaves my edge, it's on someone else's network, whether it's a carrier network or I've handed it off to Azure or Office 365 or even a third party that we're working with, it's now on someone else's network where I don't own the topology, mm-hmm. I don't own the services placement anymore. So I can't get in the middle of that flow and actually inspect the flow necessarily. I can't rely on traditional networking means to understand whether somebody's doing something that is acceptable or not acceptable. So we have to find different ways to do it. And I know Office has built-in technology for data loss prevention. There's rich technology in things like Azure Active Directory to understand whether you're seeing abnormal user behaviors. You know, David Leff is sitting right here in this chair in Redmond, Washington. It's highly unlikely that he's actually logging into his email from Syria. So we can actually see those things and detect those things in different ways than the traditional ways.
There's a new Microsoft Security Center in preview right now, and it has the ability to detect anomalistic patterns. And so it observes over time what standard access patterns are, and if it sees anything out of the ordinary, it can alert.
It's in preview.
Machine learning
we're starting
and
to
big
use,
data.
Yeah, we're yeah. starting to use machine learning and big data to secure Azure. And I'm very, very excited about the possibilities.
Yeah, that's in preview. Is that preview right now?
I think it's in preview.
Preview, I think like the free version is like a 7-day collection. I think you can go past that.
It was a third party that we acquired.
Yes, so it's super cool.
It was released as a third party, and now we're just internalizing it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really, really excited about this technology because I think with this technology and some of the work we're doing internally to kind of open source securing all of the PaaS services, I think it'll be more secure in the cloud than it could be on-prem.
So we keep it secure, but we understand our basic patterns so we know when anomalies happen. So
yes.
that's kind of the
yes.
whole package.
Yeah.
A lot of it's kind of like, you know, you want to build guardrails on it
yeah.
because you still got to protect the corporation, right? But you can't build gates or because what you then do is the promise of the cloud computing is on-demand computing, right? And being very elastic and being very agile. If you put a lot of processes in front of that, what teams will do will work around traditional IT. You'll see people start swiping credit cards. So the you can't take, you know, you still have to do, as you point around securities, you still have to do the same thing, but the method of execution does change in that
do
space.
Do it a different way.
Do it in a different way, yeah. So maybe trust but verify, right? Mm-hmm. So you still do that work, but you can't go, here's a gate, here's a gate, here's a gate, here's a gate, because people just go, okay, fine, I can go to my Azure portal with a credit card.
They'll
and
still
people,
get their work done.
They'll still get their work
yes.
done.
They'll just go around.
Just go around you. And that's yeah. something you can't have happen because the exposure could be significant to the company.
Yeah. You have to drop the friction for becoming more secure. And our security team used to have security gates, as Rob was talking about.
Yeah.
You would get subjected to this laundry list. I want to ship. Did you meet all of these requirements?
Yeah.
It's like, no. I forgot one. Oh, you can't ship. You know, go through another release. It's like, wait a minute.
But we still have security.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's actually a paper that's just been released on an IT showcase that actually talks about the security in a DevOps model.
Yeah. And what we want to do is bake security into the engineering process.
From the beginning.
And then do our security reviews of the process, not of the final
and
result.
And if you look at...
And from a SaaS standpoint, online space, Office 365, SharePoint Online, is actually more secure from a Microsoft standpoint, from a Microsoft IT standpoint, than we were able to make it on premises.
Awesome.
Right.
There are more safeguards in place in the cloud than we had or were able to afford for an on-premise.
And I think you're seeing that in the PaaS space as well. That is happening because whether you talk about Azure Security Center, if you look at the capabilities in those PaaS services, the security, the encryption kind of stuff is a lot of times is built in.
Mm-hmm.
So you can if you do your own due diligence to look at that service to say whether it meets your own security standards.
Mm-hmm.
But then you don't have to spend the time, perhaps less so, building your own custom solution around it because the solution already exists.
And with Azure Resource Manager, you can pre-configure these things to be secure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me templates and policies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Ken used a very important word, friction.
Yeah.
So security, operations process, standards, business sees that as friction. So as much of that friction we can take out of the path to getting them to be productive, better off we're going to be.
Friction is time, right? Lengthens time.
Time, procedures, time and effort, people. Everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So not only, you know, is moving the security, availability, you know, all those functions into a commoditized part of the service an advantage to the business. I love it also because I'm going to be able to simplify my network, spend less money on it, start looking at things that will actually improve the quality of service rather than, you know, potentially even degrade it in the name of security and supportability.
Okay, great. We are getting close to the end of our hour, and I want to make sure that our SMEs get an opportunity for one final question. My question is, you all have worked with the cloud-based technologies for quite some time now. What is the one tip you would like to leave our customers with today? While they're thinking about their answers to that question, I want to ask everyone to answer a couple of questions. We would love to get your feedback. We would love to find out how these sessions are working for you. So please, if you don't mind, answering a couple of questions on your screen. And with that, we'll come back to Rob. Rob, what's your tip?
It's a good question. I mean, there's a couple of different things I think about it because, you know, cloud adoption has been my focus. You know, and I talked about the pillars earlier. But ultimately, it's a Peter Drucker quote. I think it's Peter Drucker who go, and it's culture will eat strategy for breakfast. So you can have the best strategy in the world. I know this is a philosophical conversation in an IT showcase conversation, but that's ultimately where it is, right? You can have the best strategy in the world around this. You can read the white papers on this from whomever you choose from, ourselves or the technology companies out there. But it, ultimately, if your culture is not willing to change or it will does not change, it's going to be incredibly difficult to be successful. And I when I talk to customers, when I talk to business partners, whomever I'm talking to, that is the big takeaway. This isn't a transition from physical to VM. This is beyond that.
It's less about technology and
more about
people.
More about people, absolutely. So that's where I would say culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Thank you. Jim?
I would say prioritize what you put into the cloud for migration purposes. Prioritize what you put into the cloud. Use the features that your users currently don't enjoy in an on-premise environment. Use the features of the cloud as bait to get them to adopt the cloud.
Absolutely.
And last thing, treat any migration of this type as a full-blown project, have stakeholders, and a communications plan that includes not only your stakeholders, but your users as well. So treat it as a full-blown project, and you'll be successful.
Okay, great, thank you. Ken?
The focus I have right now, the tip that I have right now, is it's easy to move IaaS workloads, because a lot of your behaviors don't have to change. As we've discussed, they should change, but a lot of your behaviors don't have to change. If you don't change your behaviors, you won't enjoy the cost benefits. But you still won't be really agile. You'll still be doing patch management and securing an old topology. My tip is you're not done until you move to PaaS and SaaS. Mm-hmm. You're not done until you've upped your game. That's where the real savings are. That's what will make your company the most competitive. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to leave people with that. Please don't think your strategy's done when you've moved a workload to the cloud in IaaS. You're done when you've moved to IaaS. Yep. You moved to the next.
The real benefits come at the PaaS layer. Not necessarily the savings, the elasticity, the plethora of choices to go fix a business problem, right? Yep. That's where the value, I think, and you're completely correct, the tremendous value that comes there.
Thank you.
My tip is kind of a twist on Ken and Rob's points. So don't get too hung up on looking for parity and identical things in the cloud. You're not going to, you might not find them, period, but you definitely won't get the maximum benefit of the cloud. So if you just take what you're doing today and try to replicate it in the cloud, You're going to trip over some things, but there are new and better ways to do things in the cloud. So we had a lot of people getting hung up on, you know, the cloud doesn't offer me the 10,000 features that the on-prem version did. If you're only using 1,000 of them, why do you care about that other 9,000? Mm-hmm. People use that as a reason to not go.
An excuse.
But you know, when we started to challenge that and get people to actually articulate what are you trying to accomplish, it's that classic, you know, when you talk to a technical person, peeling the onion. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me what you're doing today, tell me what you're trying to achieve, right? Yeah. What is the capability you're looking for? Mm-hmm. What is the outcome you want? Exactly how you're doing it, because we will find find the right way to do it in the cloud for you if we can get you back to that pure intent.
And that outcome-based work that you're talking about, one of the hardest teams was our security team, getting them off of traditional controls into saying, what do you want as an outcome of these controls, and how can we do it differently?
Yeah, I really love what you said, because IT has you know, we're risk averse. That's what we've been, that's what we've built our business on, because we, you know, we don't report to, you know, this Wall Street, you know, that's a problem. So, we're very risk averse in that. And we're very good at going, yes, but, and then coming up with a litany of reasons. I need these 9,000 features. No, you don't. And I think the way I kind of describe it is, and this is somewhat of a bad joke, is if presented with the wheel, IT historically would go, that's really great, but can I get a straight edge on it just here? Because we will listen to the edge, the edge case. Don't listen to the edge case. If I can move 80%, if I can move 70% of my portfolio, the rest will come
by gravity.
By gravity alone, you know, and by that I mean that could be just data gravity alone.
Yeah.
Your data, I mean, data anchor is always the big term, right? If it's over here on premises, fair enough. But if suddenly the data gravity is now to the cloud, then they're inherently going to move. And let's get rid of the edge, right? Don't listen to the edge.
The objections, though, they're typical human nature things, right? You look for what you can identify with and what makes you feel comfortable.
And special.
Makes you feel good.
Yeah.
The cloud may make you uncomfortable at first, but eventually...
Probably will certainly make you uncomfortable.
It made us uncomfortable.
Yeah, very much
right?
so.
We're several years on, and there are still people that are uncomfortable, but I think we're better for it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Great. It is now time for us to wrap up. I do want to start by thanking our SMEs who took time away from their day job to come talk to our customers today. So thank you guys very much.
Pleasure.
And I want to thank our customers for joining us. We truly enjoy the questions and the dialogue and the opportunity to come talk to you in these sessions. You can find this video posted at Microsoft.com/IT Showcase, along with many other technical case studies, articles, other videos, lots of content on how Microsoft does IT. We have live webinars regularly, weekly, so visit our site and join us again and bring your colleagues. We'd love to see you. Thank you and have a great day.